I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, it's said that everything old is new again. For example, when I started my career in the late 60s, we were closing large institutions that were warehousing the severely mentally ill. Community care was supposed to replace long-term hospitalization. So, here we are, four decades later. Three bioethicists from Penn suggest in an article in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, that we return to asylums, and I'll put that word in quotes. Now, as bioethicists, it's their job to stir the pot a little bit and get the conversation going. And yes, as you can imagine, this article did that. But the underlying issues here is what is the most efficient and moral way of treating the long-term mentally ill. Joining us today is one of the authors of that paper, Dominic Sisti. He's an associate professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Dom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Dan.
We're also joined by Joseph Rogers. He's the chief advocacy officer at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
And our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And by the way, Dr. Sisti's article in full is on our webpage. Dom, let's start with you. Take us through a brief recent history of psychiatric institutions, how they got to be so massive, and how they got to be so inhumane.
Right. So I'm glad that at the onset you put the word asylum in quotes, because in our paper we explicitly state that we do not want to return to those asylums that you just mentioned, these large monolithic institutions that are now infamous for incarcerating, frankly, thousands of Americans in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. These were institutions like Byberry and Bridgewater State Hospital, which was portrayed in the famous documentary Titicut Follies. We do not want to return to those types of institutions. Rather, what we were calling for is a sort of rehabilitation of the term asylum to harken back to the early mental health reformers of the early 19th century, people like Dorothea Dix, Thomas Scattergood, Moses Shepherd, who used the term to describe institutions for individuals who have serious mental illness to provide them with a safe sanctuary where they may be able to heal and reclaim their lives in recovery. The institutions that were once scattered about our country were closed for a variety of reasons, both economic reasons, but also due to civil rights. The civil rights movement was, I think, largely responsible for, the closure of many of these institutions, and rightly so, frankly. The problem was there wasn't a solution on the back end that was well-funded for when patients were deinstitutionalized.
These horror stories we heard in the 70s, they were put in chemical restraints, and as we talked about, they were warehoused. Mm-hmm. And when I say chemical restraints, high doses of antipsychotic drugs, and how did we get there?
Yeah, I think the history on this is complicated, but we, I believe, got there due to resource issues. It's a lot easier to maintain control and safety in an overcrowded institution when individuals are chemically controlled. We're seeing this now in prisons, where there's probably about 15% of inmates have a serious mental illness. Their access to adequate treatment is oftentimes not great, so they are oftentimes given large doses of drug to keep them both safe and comfortable.
Let's bring Joseph Rogers on. Joseph, before you had your national reputation for advocacy work, you had your own history of mental illness, and you were hospitalized.
Yes, Dan. I've been in hospitals. I've been in jails. I've been homeless. I have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which at times has led me, incapacitated me to the point where I was psychotic and not able to take care of myself. So I ended up in hospitals, and I ended up in jail on one occasion, and ended up in a state hospital. So I've been there, been in all those places.
What was it like for you in the state hospital?
Well, in the state hospital, it was literally a madhouse. I mean, you know, when I hear the term asylum, I get my back up, because it was no asylum. These places that were established supposedly to be safe places are not safe places. A large amount of people commit suicide because they're so bad. We still run a lot of asylums. We still have a lot of state hospitals. Somehow there's this myth that the state hospitals have been closed.
Yeah, we've got one here in South Jersey, Ancora.
Yeah.
That's still open and functioning.
Ancora and Norristown State Hospital.
Norristown too, right.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was in the hospital, it was overcrowded. It was too many people. The doctors were not very well trained. There were doctors, not to put anything against foreign-born doctors, but the doctors were not people from this country, because they couldn't afford the staff with local doctors. The nurses weren't very well paid, even though...
So what was your life like in there, your daily life?
You were warehoused. I think you had used the term earlier, warehoused.
Yeah.
You got up in the morning, early in the morning. For some reason, they felt they had to wake you up at 6 o'clock in the morning. They fed you. You were fed by 7, so then you were. Then they'd open up a day room, and you would sit in the day room, and there would be this television up on the wall that was blaring, and you couldn't have any control over what was being watched, and you'd sit there. And, you know, luckily I was able to find some books. And I'm a reader, so that kind of probably saved my sanity. But for the most part, you were just sitting there with this blaring television and little to do or little interaction with anyone.
All right, so let's jump forward now to the 60s, and Dom, I'll turn back to you. It was JFK, I believe, in his progressive thinking that signed the Community Mental Health Act. And any of us progressive thinkers back then, us civil rights and human rights activists, we thought this was a perfect solution to treating people in a humane, mm-hmm. inhumane factor in state hospitals.
Right. And frankly, I still think it is. Many of these programs would work if they were adequately funded. Jimmy Carter likewise attempted to do this, only to be thwarted by the Reagan administration. So, you know, it is, I think, to my mind, not an either-or proposition here, that we need a robust community care regime in this country. But I would argue, and maybe this is where there might be some disagreement, that there's a subpopulation of the seriously mental ill who need more of a structured setting, not what Joseph just described he experienced at all. In fact, the opposite of that, a more humane, patient-centered, recovery-based type of setting that provides individuals who have serious mental illness who really cannot function in the community a safe haven to live and maybe reclaim their lives, hopefully.
Well, you know, you talked about advances being thwarted. What you're describing here, you know, is costs some money here. And Joe, you know, your dream too. I mean, to do this the right way costs, you know.
Well, I think Dominic and I have talked a little bit, and one of the things is that if you really look at what we're spending already in terms of dollars on the unfortunate way that people get end up in prison or end up in jail, or even the money we spend on homelessness and homeless shelters, we can create alternatives. One of the alternatives that we are advocating for is something called the peer respite care, which is run by and for people who have lived experience of having been hospitalized. And it has a wonderful success. There's a lot of research that even with people with some very difficult challenges, they're able to get that kind of sanctuary that Dominic is talking about in the community. It's not a locked up facility. It's a free facility where people can come and go, but they stay because the people really care about them and really work with them.
I want to break that down into some more detail, Joseph, in just a minute. I want to reintroduce both of you. That voice you were hearing is Joseph Rogers. He's the chief advocacy officer at the Mental Health Association, Southeastern Pennsylvania. Dominic Sisti is an associate professor of medical ethics at University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about the chronically mentally ill and how best to care for them. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you or a loved one have experienced this, or if you or a loved one, you know, has severe mental illness, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Dominic, back in the beginning, coming back to state hospitals, I mean, we talked about drugs and we talked about, you know, the cost efficiency back then. I want to come back to the cost issue and where we are in this mm-hmm. country and our priorities.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, it's this is the most vulnerable.
Exactly.
Population.
I think that
people in poverty are the most vulnerable. And, you know, we just don't have the appetite.
Well, I don't know if we don't have the appetite, but we don't seem to have the moral courage
right.
to do the right thing. You know, a budget, in my mind, is a moral document. And when it, you know, when money's being spent on, you know, defense and other very big ticket items to the detriment of our most vulnerable populations, that should say something about the morality of our society, frankly. And that's really was that, you know, in a lot of ways, that was the impetus for this paper. It's the idea that we're leaving our most vulnerable people in languishing in prisons, on the streets, and with substandard mental health care is a moral stain on our society.
And not looking at them in the eye, pretending they're not there.
That's right.
You know? And what does that do to us as individuals? So to both of you, you know, I think in our hearts back then, our hearts were in the right place. They really were. And so help us understand why things didn't work out very well. Joseph, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, I think, we have done, you know, one issue I have with Dominic's article is he didn't really talk about, he's in Philadelphia, and he didn't talk about the Philadelphia experience, where we have done a good job. We closed down Philadelphia State Hospital. And the people that were in Philadelphia State Hospital, in fact, his university, Pennsylvania University, researched those individuals. And 5 years later, they found that those individuals were housed, they had places to live, they had occupation, they had people following up, case management, they had the services. And really, the cost was equal, at least, to what the cost of institutionalizing the people was. So we can do it. We know how to do it. We know how to close down hospitals, and we've closed down several in Pennsylvania, and created community-based care that follows the individual into the community and provides for their individualized needs. That's the big code to this thing, is making sure that it's individualized in the treatment. So we know how to do it. As Dominic has pointed out, do we have the moral obligation? Do we have the power politically? Currently, we did it. We did it well. But currently, under the previous administration, the administration that's just outgoing now, they cut back on those services. They cut 10% on mental health services. So it's not a matter of needing asylums. It's a matter of funding things that we know, evidence-based programs that we know that work for even the most seriously mentally ill in the community, and we need to fund those fully and not see them become budget basketball where they get bounced around as a way to try and make your budget and not maybe raise some taxes.
I want to see if we can get a caller in before we have to take our first break. We've got Mike on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing, fellas?
Good. What can we do for you?
I just wanted to add a comment. I'm a therapist at Norristown State Hospital. And first, I'd just like to say the word asylum really doesn't belong in this dialogue. It's a very antiquated word that brings up that conjures images of very, very poorly managed facilities. And I can tell you, after working at one for the last 10 years, it's just simply not that way. We're accredited, we're inspected routinely. Our programming is robust. We've got five-day-a-week programming for the patients. And I can tell you that we're lumping all the patients into a category as a chronically mentally ill. It's difficult to talk about because you really have several. You've got the people who can be reintegrated into their lives, as you pointed out. You've got the ones who have some kind of disability, whether it's a chronic mental illness, schizophrenia, maybe a decrease in functioning due to severe drug use. And then we have the violently mentally ill, which is the population I work with in the forensic setting. So as you just talk about asylums, whether or not we put them in the community or warehouse them, it really does, it's an injustice to the current system because there's such a gradient of population out there. And, of course, you mentioned individualized programming. The problem is, and you said it, is funding. We are constantly battling for funding to keep programming useful and viable for each individual patient, but it's a struggle.
Mike, I really appreciate your call, and I appreciate your adding this nuance to the discussion. It sure does drive the conversation. Thanks so much. Dom, you were the guy that got criticized, or your article got criticized.
Sure, and I think I actually would agree with most of what Michael said. In fact, I would agree with the fact that the word asylum is an anachronism, and that's actually how we stipulated in the JAMA piece. So if you go and read the JAMA piece, we say explicitly that the term asylum is meant to be used in the early sort in the early sense of the word from our psychiatric reformers who spoke of providing sanctuary. If it is a distraction, if it's creating too much controversy, I'm fine with using a different word, but it is a word that is historically accurate.
I should also say, though, in all fairness, I think if you did not use the word asylum, it wouldn't have gotten the publicity it got.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah. Is that what bioethicists do? Do you kind of...
Yes and no, and Joseph's laughing. I think that the role of the bioethicist in society is to try to, raise very difficult questions and come at social problems in a way that sometimes is provocative. I'll say for myself, provocation was not the intention here. It was really just to allude to a concept from history that I think is actually a very smart concept.
So it's not like you're a professional pain in the butt.
Well, I mean, yeah, we are in a certain sense. Good. Gadflies, so to speak.
Good. Damn, I've been doing that my whole life. I never got paid for it, though. Listen, we're gonna have to take a short break. We'll be back in just 1 minute. We're talking about, I'm generalizing here, but the chronically mentally ill who wind up either in homeless or in prisons or in these, quote, institutions, and what's the best way to care for them. We're talking with Dominic Sisti, who wrote the article that started this whole thing. He's an associate professor, medical ethics at Penn. By the way, the article was also written with Ezekiel Emanuel and Andrea Siegel, and it's on our webpage. We're also speaking with Joseph Rogers, chief advocacy officer at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has worked to provide loving and clinical care to some of the most vulnerable members of society, including individuals on the autism spectrum. Austin, who first attended a Devereaux school at age 5, was almost entirely unable to communicate. Through a combination of his mother's advocacy, his hard work, and the support of Devereaux, he said, "I love you," to his mother for the first time. More about Devereaux's programs and services online at devereaux.org.
The model for our winter FM campaign has been compared to school with recess, even a donut. I'm Jennifer Lynn. Here's the idea. To make this drive as efficient as possible, we're only taking short breaks in the middle of the drive to ask for membership. Is this a risk? Yes, it is. We still need to raise $75,000 over these 3 days. Do your part to make this experiment a success. Call 888-345-9499. You get it. You value it. Choose to support it.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about the best way to care for our chronically, severely mentally ill. We're talking with Dr. Dominic Sisti and Joseph Rogers. Well, I want to talk about what works and what doesn't with, you know, these large institutions. Didn't work, right. with exceptions like, you know, Norristown State Hospital, and I'm not sure what goes on at Ancora. Certainly prisons and homelessness doesn't work either. Tom, as you stated in your article, many of this population go from hospitals to streets to emergency rooms to prison, and you've gone through that cycle over and over.
Yes, that's one thing we found in our research was that there's a subpopulation. It's hard to say how many individuals this is, but they seem to be stuck in a vicious cycle whereby they decompensate, end up in an emergency room only to be treated and stabilized and then sent or released back out into the community where they have trouble accessing the community care services that they really could benefit from. They may become disruptive, become publicly dangerous in some ways, and be arrested and incarcerated. It's really difficult to get a population census, and two, a cost figure on this cycle. But it's enormously expensive, can tell from just speaking with clinicians who I've spoken with in the past few weeks. You know, they see the same patients, you know, week after week after week, and they are distressed as clinicians themselves because they can't seem to figure out how to give them the best care they need.
Joseph, one of the reasons we wanted to do this show is because we wanted to have resources out there for people with chronic mental illness. Let's go to the phones, and I want to hear your comment on this next call. It's with Scott. Scott, hi. You're on Voices. We don't have him. Al, do we have Scott up? Okay, we'll get to Scott in a minute. But Joe, in your opinion, what works and what doesn't?
Well, we find that first place we have to treat people as individuals, and we don't like to really label people as the mentally ill. We talk about right. people with mental health challenges, and the reality is that it's a real variety of folks. What we have found here in Philadelphia at the Mental Health Association is that we have to really meet the person where they're at. Philadelphia is wonderful; got a lot of wonderful examples. Not to say that there aren't people that we still are struggling with, but we've had lots and hundreds of wonderful examples where programs like the Project Home with Sister Mary Scullion and with Dr. Arthur Evans at the City Office of Mental Health, where we've created individualized outreach efforts to work with people. We had a program called the Access. We have a program called the Access Program, and it's based on outreach. One of the things that we learned very early on is that we said that you talked about the community mental health center. Well, you set up a big center and you put the counselor up on the fourth or fifth floor and expect people with serious problems to, you know, make an appointment and come up to the fourth or fifth floor. It's not going to work. What you need to do is be in the street. You need to make the relationships in the street. You need to work with people where they're at. You need to find out exactly what things that they're concerned about, issues that they're concerned about that you can address. And by addressing those issues, you gain their trust. And through gaining their trust, you're able to help a person, you know, seek and get the work they support they need. Dominic, and I think you, Dr., also talked earlier about this heavy reliance on medication. One thing that does not work is over-medicating people, and this heavy reliance on medication. Many people do much better on either very small amounts of medication or no medication at all. Medication itself can create side effects and terrible you can actually, sometimes the behavior you're seeing is a behavior as a result of heavy medication.
Sometimes
you need to find alternatives.
Sometimes it is, but we need to preface your opinion by saying you're not a physician.
But I'm a person who's been on heavy medication, and I can tell you that over-medicating somebody is almost as worse as not medicating as the not medication.
Well, okay, we'll leave that as is. I mean, I really, Joseph, I greatly respect your opinion and your experience with that. Let's go to Scott. We've got Scott back on the line. Hi, Scott.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Dan, I'm a longtime listener. I'm a father of a loved one who suffers. For the last 5 years, I've been educating myself and advocating for my young son. And now the cause has grown to where I advocate for people that I'm not familiar with. Right now, I've just been appointed to a board that is in charge of implementation of a new way to handle nonviolent criminal offenders. So these gentlemen are speaking about a very broad swatch. When you talk about mental illness, yes, there's people that need to be incarcerated for long periods of time, maybe possibly people without family support or with families who don't know what to do with them. And these are vitally important places when you talk about Ancora or Norristown State Hospital. There's souls that need to fit into there. I want to just mention what's going on around the country with other states. California was the first to deinstitutionalize. Well, now I've been privy to read a report by Stanford University, which has had direct impact on California, changing the way they're handling their nonviolent offenders, mentally ill nonviolent offenders, to get rid of the recidivism and this constant picking up off the street. I call it the revolving door kind of scenario, which is very costly, as you've heard. They're saying right now they're spending, for every dollar that they're spending with their new mental health court systems in keeping this reincarceration from happening, they're saving about $7 for every cost of incarceration.
So
they were spending.
What's the option there? So they're not putting them, they're not incarcerating them. What happens?
Well, I'll tell you from my own personal experience.
Please.
I have a loved one who found his way into the Philadelphia court system. And through advocacy and care, we found out that Philadelphia has a mental health court. This is a place that's quiet. It has its own docket. It's a non-crowded environment. And once a person is introduced into that court, they're followed by that court. So it kept my loved one from being incarcerated. Now, you know, most people don't know this, but mental illness has different degrees and depths. So somebody who's mildly delusional or possibly mildly psychotic, if they're incarcerated, that becomes a totally different picture. They go into a much more severe psychosis.
The trauma of it is, a lot of this is trauma related, and if you further traumatize somebody, they're going to get sicker.
Yeah, exactly. They're isolated. They have no privacy, and typically, it becomes a worst case scenario. So Philadelphia quietly is leading the way. So I'm working right now with the New Jersey judiciary under the Supreme Court to implement a new way, a compassionate way of a diversionary process where these people aren't incarcerated.
Scott, I'm going to have to ask you. We're going to have to say goodbye to you. But before we do, I would you mind terribly if you sent us those resources, what you're discovering and learning? I want to put a ton of resources up on our webpage for our listeners. I'd appreciate that, and I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you. It would be my privilege. Thank you.
Joseph, so here's my question. You know, Scott was talking about his loved one, and his loved one has a loved one who can shepherd him through this. But what about those who don't out in the community? Who really
I think
are
that's
alone?
That's a big part of the problem, is a lot of times family members either burn out from the situation or just aren't around. My family was around for a while, and then I moved out of the area and they weren't around. So I didn't have family to help me. So we've got to create, in a sense, we've got to kind of create an artificial family. One of the things the peer respite program does is it uses peers who have been trained to work one-on-one with individuals in crisis and provide a home-like, family-like environment for them to work through their crisis and prevent that hospitalization, even prevent going into a jail. And by preventing that hospitalization and preventing that jail experience, you prevent further traumatization, which leads people to kind of the chronicity that we've talked about. The more you get traumatized, there's an accumulative effect. The more likely you're going to end up being a person with a chronic situation.
I want to talk about boarding homes, and Dom, I don't recall if you touched on this in your article, but you know, the boarding homes in the community, and everybody's looking for housing, but you know, boarding homes really cuts both ways. Our own Mike and Scott looked into this extensively and found horrible abuses in boarding homes. I mean,
yeah,
including not just the physical plan being falling apart. It was unsupervised. On some occasions, they were stealing Social Security checks.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. And I think this gets to one of the major reforms that has to happen, which is payment reform and how we support individuals who have serious mental illness financially. And how, you know, their care is reimbursed, for example. So we can't simply say we need new resources, new locations, new treatment modalities. We need new reimbursement structures such that the incentive is in place for institutions, boarding homes, long-term structured residencies, et cetera, to provide to not simply provide services for the sake of providing services, but for an outcome that's measurable and positive for, you know, the patient.
Joseph, I'm sure you agree that there is a population of people that has difficulty functioning on the outside. What do you propose for this population?
Well, I think we're looking at people who need help and need support. There's a wonderful program in Philadelphia called Housing First, and the idea is that you provide the housing first. You provide a decent, affordable housing unit for that person, and then you build the help and supports around the person based on their needs. And at first, that may be 24-hour. You may need to even have somebody live with the person. But then most cases, 99% of people with serious mental health challenges, it's a matter of cycles. And so once a person gets through the crisis and is on the other end, you may not have to give 24-hour care. So you can bring the care back a little bit. You can do it a daily visit. You can also help the person get involved and out in the community and getting their supports by being part of the community.
Do we have? I want to ask both of you this, and I'll turn to you. Do we have that in place now? Is it available now, or is it a dream, Joseph?
No, we have Housing First exists. It's again, we don't have enough. We have a waiting list. But it was established in Philadelphia and targeted the people that were long-term homeless individuals. Sister Mary Scullion made a big issue. She was a wonderful advocate that we spend the money and the resources and we target the most at need, that we not cream in a sense, that we find those who've been on the streets and that it was limited to you had lived on the street for a year or more to get the housing. And we've done that for about 900 people. We need it for another 1,000 or 2,000 people. But again, we saw cutbacks in the state budget. Hopefully with the new administration, though, we're challenged with the legislators that we see resources dedicated to this kind of program.
No, I mean, Joe is absolutely right on this. It used to be the case that housing only came with conditions. You did your treatment, you jumped through these hoops, you showed up to meetings, and that was just backwards. You need a home first to establish yourself and, you know, in order to recover. The question, I think, still remains, however, for persons who are unable to live in a home on their own for a long period of time, what do we do for them? And I'm, you know, recalling a case of a woman who had a severe personality disorder and maybe Munchausen's disorder, in which she would chronically eat or ingest foreign objects, showed up to the emergency room pretty much every week with, foreign nails, screws, even, parts of scissors in her stomach. This went on for years until they realized she cannot be alone in a home. She needs something more protective. While I agree with Joseph that Housing First works and makes sense, there's going to be this subpopulation that needs extra structure.
Well, and Joe, I'm going to have to cut you off because we do have to break. But it sounds like the one thing we all are agreeing on is nothing grows without safety, and it's got to be safety first. Like I said, we've got to take a short break. We are talking about the best way to care, and I'm losing the right word to use now. Anyway, the chronically severely mentally ill. We're talking with Dr. Dominic Sisti, an assistant professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, who published a paper along with Ezekiel Emanuel and Andrea Siegel in the Journal of the American Medical Association. We're also speaking with Joseph Rogers, Chief Advocacy Officer at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. To our callers, we will get to the phones, I promise, in this third segment. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY. FM.
This is not your mom's pledge drive. It's not even the same pledge drive as last year. I'm Dave Davies. Why is it not the same pledge drive? Because we're trying to shorten it. At the start of this campaign, we reminded you why member support is important, and at the end of this drive, we'll be back to finish off the campaign. But in the middle, we're hoping you'll call with short reminders like this one. And there's more. If we can make $75,000 during these 3 days without live pledge breaks, an anonymous group of donors will give WHYY an additional $20,000. Help us make this quiet part of the campaign a success. Consider signing up as a sustainer for $9 a month. As a sustainer, you set your pledge and forget it. Your contribution's deducted automatically from your credit card or bank account monthly or annually. It's easy for you and effective for WHYY. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org. Will this experiment work? That's up to you. Please call now.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We are talking about those with chronic severe mental illness and how to best care for them. We've got lots of people on the lines who want to join us. Let's start with Christy. Hi, Christy.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. You?
Good. I was a patient at Norristown recently. I ended up there for some severe depression. And the reason that I'm calling is that I think that the term asylum actually still very much does apply. I was forced to take medication against my will. I was disrespected. Anytime I tried to advocate for myself, I was told to cooperate or threatened with a longer stay. And I thought it was completely unethical. And I think it just goes to show how few rights you have when you are deemed mentally ill.
Well, I so appreciate the call. How long have you been out, Christy?
A few weeks. I was only there for 6 days. I ended up there. I'm a stay-at-home mother, and I ended up there for depression, and there are various levels of people who are there. I don't think that it is set up to help people succeed. So many people have chronic physical problems that lead to their mental illness. I myself have Lyme disease, which has contributed to mine.
Yeah, of course.
Many people were just drugged.
Did you get
in the halls?
Did you get any therapy, Christy?
No, and I repeatedly told them about my illness and how medications affect me, and I was forced to take medications still, and I was not a threat to myself or to other people.
So let me.
And
did you go in voluntarily?
I did, and then I was forced to stay longer because I was threatened
this,
with. And I was trying to be an advocate. I'm an educated person. I'm a college educated person, and I was trying to advocate for myself, and I was not listened to.
I'm going to ask our experts to comment, and I'm going to ask you to take it off the air. But Christy,
okay.
I just want to repeat the question I asked you when you first came on the line.
Mm-hmm.
How are you? How are you doing?
You know, I'm seeing an outpatient therapist, and I'm doing better. That experience at Norristown State Hospital scarred me for life.
Yeah.
It was very extreme.
Yeah, Joseph talked about the trauma of hospitalization. Christy, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're seeing a good therapist and that you're doing better. Take good care. Dom?
Yeah, so I thank you, Christy, for your sharing that with us. You know, this is exactly what we want to avoid, which is these institutions becoming somewhat sort of impervious to criticism, to making individuals stay longer than they need to stay, to basically locking away people. We need to have structures in place at these institutions to allow individuals to have a voice and to be able to say, look, I need to be with my family, I need to be in the community. And, you know, when we talk about what we're proposing in our JAMA paper, we describe it as a safe milieu that is based on recovery-based principles. Now, that sounds a little paradoxical to talk about an institution that's based on recovery-based principles. But the idea there is that you do give a voice to the patient in a way that they don't have right now. And I think that is, you know, the crucial difference.
Well, that's what we all want, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We want a voice.
Yes. And, you know, I think that, you know, Joseph's group, the Mental Health Association, they have advocacy groups that work on behalf of patients in hospitals, and we need more of those groups. I think, to me, those are the models of sort of an ethics-type committee that reviews and keeps track of individuals who are in the institutions so they aren't forgotten.
But Dominic, you know, and I know that you want to get questions, Dr. Grappoli, but one of the things is that we've tried this with institutions like Norristown, even smaller institutions. It seems to be, and I don't know, and we need to do some research on this, once you start getting large congregate-type programs, even when you're talking about 15, 20, 30 people, the right situation is problematic. And, you know, I know myself that it's at 3 o'clock in the morning when there are no advocates around and there is no chance to make a phone call to an advocate that the abuses take place. So unfortunately, this model of somehow a safe institution or safe congregate living place is not one that's really borne out with years and years and years of research on it.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Natalie on the line. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. So I just want to say so much of what you're talking about is what I deal with constantly. Right now, I'm working for a mental health justice-involved services team. And our organization actually also works closely with the Mental Health Association in our area. We're in South Jersey. And really, so much of this just pertains to what I'm doing. I'm in the jail, the county jail, almost every day. I just left there right before calling. I'm dealing with clients coming in and out. We deal with the homeless population. And it's such a struggle to get them what they need. It takes so long. We lose contact. We're pulling them back in. I have one particular client who has been, he's extremely ill. It's very sad. The first time I met him, he had been in the county jail for close to a year. When I saw him, he was in 23-hour lockdown. It was a very sad state. We got him out of jail. He ended up being kicked out of the shelter that was around us for his behavior. He has assault charges that I believe are directly linked to his schizophrenia that's not treated. He doesn't believe he has schizophrenia. But, I mean, it's just that case alone. This is my third time dealing with him in the jail, and he keeps gaining charges. I mean, that's the poster boy for, I think, what you're talking about.
Yeah, you said you're in South Jersey. I mean, it's just these kinds of stories that, and I'm sure it's part of the incentive for Dr. Sisti and colleagues to write this article. And it's just this kind of story that you know, was why Joseph Rogers began the important work he's doing. Either of you have a reaction to Natalie, and not a theoretical one, but what's out there for her?
Well, I think in South Jersey we need to do a lot of advocacy. I mean, and fortunately in Philadelphia we have a lot of resources that they don't have in southern New Jersey. I live in southern New Jersey. I live in Cherry Hill, not too far from you, Dr. Gottlieb. Mm. But and you know what I have found out here is that we don't have the resources and the alternatives. We don't have the jail diversion programs. We don't have the mental health court that I know of. And those are things we need to start speaking out and making our voices heard. And I've been working with the Advocacy Committee of the Mental Health Association of Southwestern New Jersey, and they're very aware of these issues and very interested in organizing.
Well, now we know where your work has to be, and you can save a schlep into Philly every day.
Yeah,
you
right.
Could save
I'll tell my boss that. Yeah.
You could save a couple of bucks. So
I would just say Natalie's basically channeled the sentiments of dozens of clinicians and attorneys and one judge who sent me a letter about their frustrations, and trying to figure out the right thing to do, frankly, for a vulnerable patient.
Yeah, I mean, so, everybody's
in the end, everybody's trying to do the right thing.
Everybody's heart's in the right place.
Right.
So we've got a caller here who says she takes care of two 65-year-olds with mental illness, and she's having trouble finding a place for them to live. I mean, it's the housing issue again, and you know, we talked about things today in the ideal, but housing is not as available as it's needed, and we're desperately in need of more housing. Joseph, I'm sure you would agree.
We probably need, in terms of supported housing units, probably 3,000 or 4,000 more than we currently have, and that would just address people that have the serious homeless issues, people that are in jail, rotating in and out of hospitals and jails, and I'm talking just Philadelphia alone, not the whole region. So yes, we desperately need it. It's something we're meeting with the new governor and the new secretary for Health and Human Services about, and they're saying help us with the legislators, because it's a budget issue, and unfortunately, that's where it's money, and we've got a population that doesn't want to see, pay the taxes and pay for the support. And, you know, as long as we don't have the resources, we're going to see these problems, and they're going to get worse, not better.
Dom, let me ask you, what's to change gears here? Mm-hmm. What's your dream for the future?
My dream for the future? Well, you know, I think to see a continuum of care for the mentally ill that includes outpatient treatment where you can get an appointment within a week as opposed to within 3 months or 6 months, accessibility to mental health care for children, both community-based, evidence-based, community-based care for the large number of mentally ill persons who can live and thrive in the community, but also, just like we have in medical care, hospital situations that allow for the treatment of individuals who cannot, for a time, be in the community. That's what I think would be my dream for the future.
Hmm. Joe?
My dream is that we create those voices. I love the show Voices in the Family, voices of the family, voices of people who are lived experience, who have been diagnosed, because that's the only way we're going to change things, is that we massively organize and create a strong voice, not only of the people with the challenges, but also of allies and support for those people. Because I think there is, you know, one thing Dominic's article has done, not that I agree with a lot of things, but one thing he has done is we've created some noise, and what we need to do is create more noise.
I think that's great. And Joseph Rogers, you nailed what the title of the show is really about. It's about hearing voices, not just of an individual family, but the families in our larger community. So I want to thank you, Dominic Sisti. I want to thank you too very much for the work you're doing, and you know, and please keep making a fuss here. Raise hell, please. We're joined by Joseph Rogers as Chief Advocacy Officer of the Mental Health Association. Dominic Sisti is an Assistant Professor of Medical Ethics at Penn. Well, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. You can email us at voices@whyy.org. And my webpage is drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Zakiya Gibbons is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.